Welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. I am your host, Preston Schleinkofer. This week's show is brought to you by doTERRA's On Guard Beadlets and On Guard Plus Protective Blend Soft Gels. These are my family's main products for maintaining our health, especially during the colder months when there are more chances of getting sick. The beadlets are 1/4 of a drop of the blended essential oils that makes this so effective at doing its job. The proprietary blend of oils like wild orange peel, clove bud, black pepper, cinnamon leaf and bark, oregano, eucalyptus, rosemary, and melissa are combined to make this a favorite blend for good health. You may find more about these great oils at our website at Oils for Life Today. That's oils4lifetoday.com. Or you can go directly to the On Guard link at the bottom of the show notes for this episode. So let's get on with the show. This week, we're going to be with Drew Bumbeck again, and we're going to be talking about something even more spectacular than last time, which I've never heard of this thing called an arc storm before. But in doing a little bit of research, I found out that this may not be so far-fetched, or that in the last 1,800 years, that there have been a number of storms that may have been worse than the latest storm, which happened in 1861 through 1862. So, Drew, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Preston. It's good to be with you.
It's my pleasure, man. I have fun talking with you about all these catastrophic events. You know, we gotta know about these things because they can affect us, and we need to be aware of them so that we're not caught unawares and blindsided by these things, and that we're prepared for these things. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree. I think something that where we kind of fall down in this country, we are prepared for the what I like to refer to as run-of-the-mill disasters. You know, okay, well, there's a snowstorm, and we're going to be snowed in for a few days. We might lose power for a day or two. Or there's a hurricane coming, and it's time to evacuate. And even there, with hurricanes and other things like that, we sometimes don't do the greatest job. But when it comes to catastrophic disasters, there are a number of major catastrophic threats to either the entire country, the entire world, as we talked about with solar storms, or you know, parts of the country, and people are completely ignorant of them and just don't know about them because it's just not well publicized. And some of these, you know, are not going to be as horrendous on a scale as you know, an EMP attack on the U.S. or a, you know, Carrington class event, geomagnetic storm, where, you know, we're talking 90% of the population dead in the first year after it happened, but at least regionally, it can be hugely devastating. But a lot of folks just aren't aware of it.
Yeah, and part of that, you're an emergency manager, you're trained for that, and you're a specialist in this industry. But I think that many emergency managers, they're too busy doing their day-to-day stuff, and they don't have the opportunity to really dig into what some of these extracurricular activities, you know, extra storms and phenomena can bring upon them. It really boggles the mind when you think about why some of these things are not at least talked about and on a list at the state level and even at the local level as far as being a threat. So maybe you can give some insight into why emergency managers don't know about or don't plan for these things.
Well, I think, you know, you hit the nail right on the head there with your first statement about that, is that most, particularly at the local level, most emergency managers are too busy doing their day-to-day job And their day-to-day job is, you know, it varies depending on the jurisdiction one is working in. And, you know, some places, some of the bigger, wealthier jurisdictions, like, you know, say, City of Dallas or Fairfax County, Virginia, or Montgomery County, Maryland, or, you know, New York City, they've got an emergency management agency that is fairly robust. You know, they've got a number of employees. They've got, you know, in some cases, several hundred employees. But when it comes down to it, most local or municipal or county emergency management agencies, they have between one to five people working for them. And they have a lot of work to do in being compliant with the requirements that they're under and just keeping up with the disasters that they may have to contend with on a regular basis during the course of the year, without, you know, being, and so they're left with no time to go on and research what kind of, you know, one-off catastrophic disasters might hit my jurisdiction in the next, you know, 25 years, 50 years, 100 years.
Right.
And is there anything we can do to mitigate against that or prepare for it? And unfortunately, as a community, emergency management, kind of like most other communities, I mean, you hear it in medicine. When you hear hoofbeats, look for a horse, not a zebra. Meaning, you know, yeah. if you see somebody with hives all over them, think that they might be having an allergic reaction rather than, oh, it might be smallpox. And that kind of translates to EM as well. You know, when you hear hoofbeats, well, what kind of disaster? We're not talking catastrophic that, you know, it's, you know, once in every 250 years, even though we're like Cascadia, you know, overdue for it or something like that.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And no, that's okay. And we don't, as a community, our associations, and our national leadership, with very few exceptions, doesn't really make a concerted effort to inform folks of, hey, these are the catastrophic events that or threats that we face. You know, we used to prior to 2009. FEMA had a catastrophic planning branch that unfortunately got disbanded in 2009 when the administration changed and priorities changed. Now, I will say I am somewhat heartened by some things that FEMA has been doing. I mean, for example, as we discussed a few weeks ago, national level exercise 11 or NLE 11 was New Madrid, which obviously is a major catastrophic quake incident. And then I think coming up 2022, and correct me if I get the date wrong, but NLE 22 is going to be Cascadia, which again is another major catastrophic incident.
So, I think that was so, 21, you know, but
yeah, I think yeah. You might be right.
Yeah.
So then, they're focusing on some, but we do need to keep getting the word out because, you know, there are a lot of potential threats that we haven't, that a lot of EMs around the country don't realize that they might encounter.
Yeah. Well, you know, in looking, I never knew anything about this arc storm scenario because that I don't live in California. I don't intend to live in California, but you know, that's a California specific incident that it is, you know, potentially very catastrophic, which has cascading effects across the country because it affects the Central Valley, and that's where most of our country's fruits and vegetables and almonds are grown. And, you know, so that would have devastating effects, especially flood heights of greater than 14 feet in some portions of that. In the USGS map that I have here, and I'll put links to these in the show notes, people can go and look. At the bottom of this one, it shows a huge, I don't know what, let's look. It must be close to 50 kilometers wide by a couple hundred long. The major portion of this flooding in the Central Valley is greater than 14 feet. And so there's a lot of small communities in that zone, as well as probably, you know, I don't know, maybe close to a million people or more. So there's, I mean, that could affect a lot of people outside of that, just from their friends and relatives being involved in that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. You know, arc storm, and you said, you know, a lot of folks outside of California don't know about it. As a matter of fact, a lot of folks inside California also don't know about it, because, I mean, let's be brutally honest. When you, to the average person in this country, when you say disasters in California, I mean, what are they going to think about? Their primary thought is earthquakes, the big one.
Earthquakes and fires now.
And wildfires.
Yeah.
And they don't think weather-related disasters, except for wildfires, you know, from drought and heat. But, you know, California does have, and they sure as heck don't think water disasters, because, well, it never rains in California, and, you know, they're always under drought. Well, that's not true. And California does, on every year, I mean, they have some kind of rain-related disaster, like landslides or the you know, the dam that almost let go a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Orville Dam. But they never think absolute devastating flood that will affect, you know, that will be something like, you know, I think 50 to 60 miles or 20 or more miles east to west and 300 miles long. You know, they don't think that, but there is the potential for this.
Yeah. You know, this website talks about the economic impact is 700, and this was back, I think it was 2011, they did this exercise in California to at least see what would happen. They brought together scientists and specialists and people like you to come in and go over the possibilities. It says the $725 billion figure comprises approximately $400 billion in property damage and $325 billion in business interruption losses. I mean,
exactly. Actually, it's older than that, because the study that came up with those numbers is from like 2007, 2008.
Oh, wow.
So we're talking, you know, 11, 12-year-old data here.
Uh-huh.
And in that time, you know, inflation has certainly gone ahead.
Oh, yeah.
And things are certainly, you know, things are definitely more expensive than 12 years ago. And so I would not be surprised if an arc storm scenario now would be projected to be over $1 trillion worth of loss. I really wouldn't, because also what you're looking at is, you not only are you looking at an increase in the cost just based on, you know, 2008, 2009 dollars to 2019 dollars, but I think you're looking at more people in the affected area, more structures that will be damaged or destroyed, more businesses that will be interrupted. And so I think that's importantly, I mean, that's incredibly, it's significant. And I think it's going to be a significant increase the next time we revisit this and see what an arc storm would do. And actually, as a quick aside, I just realized we never actually defined for folks who are listening what an arc storm is.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah. As people will see when they look at your show page, it's really spelled strangely. It's capital AR, small K, capital S, and then the rest of it is lowercase, but all run together in one word. And you know, ark obviously, you know, brings to mind the thought of Noah's Ark and you know, surviving a flood. And it is a flood scenario, but the AR stands for atmospheric river. The K stands for 1,000. And then, of course, storm is, you know, a storm. But it's basically an incredibly severe winter storm that can strike the West Coast, can strike California, and as we've already noted, have devastating consequences. And I think, you know, we've thrown out that this is based on, quote, atmospheric rivers. And that may be confusing to some folks, too, because, you know, it's people are thinking, what do you mean, rivers in the atmosphere? But it's just that's just a meteorological name for this phenomenon that causes arc storms. And what it is and as a matter of fact, most of the severe precipitation in California, and atmospheric rivers are essentially just jets of warm, moist air that originate over the mid-latitude of the North Pacific Ocean. And they just transport huge, massive amounts of moisture to California, where much of the moisture turns to rain and snow that falls on the state. And as a matter of fact, one of the graphics that I sent you is a map of the Pacific region showing an atmospheric river that generates flooding, and from NOAA. And so, and you mentioned the Great Flood of 1861 to 1862, and that is not dissimilar to an arc storm. And, you know, that Great Flood resulted after 45 days of rain and intense winter storms that caused severe inundation throughout northern and southern California and made the Central Valley essentially impassable. And it basically turned the Central Valley into an inland sea. It wiped out a third of the taxable land in California in that period of time. It essentially bankrupted the state. And as an anecdotal aside, it forced Governor Leland Stanford to travel to his inauguration in a rowboat.
Oh, wow.
That's the only way he could get to his inauguration. While most severe precipitation in California comes from atmospheric rivers, arc storms are unique among all of these storms because, you know, as you noted, they can produce massive amounts of precipitation, do massive damage, and the precipitation levels that they produce exceeds levels that are only experienced or at least expected once every 500 to 1,000 years in many places in the state. So you're talking, you know, 1,000-year flooding, which doesn't mean it can't happen every other year. It just means that statistically it should only happen once every 1,000 years.
Right. You know, you mentioned a coronal mass ejection earlier, geomagnetic storm. We had a coronal mass ejection in the 1859, which was a Carrington event. 2 years later,
yep.
2 years later, this thing happened. You think there's a correlation?
You know, I don't know. I have heard people say that, well, sunspots cause earthquakes. And, you know, I have seen some research that seems to indicate that maybe that might be the case. I've seen other research that indicates, yeah, there's nothing there. That's a big nothing burger. I don't know, and I don't think that anyone can actually say for certain, because there are a lot of interconnections that we don't know about or that we're just discovering. I mean, for example, for the longest time, we always thought that earthquakes were one-off events. Even though we knew, you know, what the concept of plate tectonics was and what the various, plates, the plates of the earth are, even though we knew that all the tectonic plates are interconnected, we didn't think that an earthquake on, you know, say San Andreas, for example, would have an effect on a fault line 500 miles away or 2,500 miles away. But now we're starting to find that when you have a major quake, say, off the coast of Chile. When you have a 9.0 subduction zone quake off of Chile, that the stress from that, while some of that is relieved, some of it is bumped up, and some of that increased stress gets transmitted across other fault lines, and it really, so for example, one quake on the Ring of Fire in the Pacific can actually stress all the other fault lines on the Pacific and put just a little bit more tension on them. And it may, you know, that little bit more tension may be insignificant, or it may, in the case of a fault that's really close to letting go anyway, it might possibly be the straw that breaks the camel's back. And you find that tides and hurricanes and things like that, the extra water that amasses, the extra water mass that amasses over a tectonic plate can also have an effect on quakes and volcanoes and stuff. So, you know, who am I to say that whether or not a coronal mass ejection and a major geomagnetic storm like a Carrington event could or could not cause this? I mean, we might someday find out that, yep, these things are closely related, or we might find out that, yeah, they're actually, it was just coincidental, you know, and who knows, because everything is, there's a lot we don't know about how our universe and our world works.
Yeah, it's, it just seems kind of suspicious to me. It seems like sometimes things go in a series of years, you know, one thing, and you know, the sun affects our wave action. And so,
yep.
You know, it just, I was thinking, well, why wouldn't it not affect these rivers? So,
and you know, the other thing too is you have to, I mean, you can obviously say that the sun does affect these, because, I mean, the sun drives our weather.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Because as parts of the atmosphere heat and other parts cool, you know, that drives high and low pressure and temperature changes and water vapor, the water cycle. And so it's certainly possible that when you have a major CME like the Carrington, like the one that was associated with the Carrington event, and major solar storms like were associated with the Carrington event, it's possible that, you know, either the sun is in a super maximum, mm-hmm. or that the solar flare and the CME put enough extra energy into the atmosphere to ramp things up. Who knows? And so I think this is still something that we're going to be learning more about as the years go by.
Hmm. Yeah, it's crazy. There's a video at the bottom of one of these pages from the USGS. It's a short couple minute video that talks about it's a little over 3 minutes. It talks, you know, it gives an overview of the arc storm and kind of a cartoonish video about, you know, cattle floating upside down in this flooded prairie and guys on horseback and things like that. But, you know, back in 1860, 61, that's the way it was. They were they were true cowboys back there. And it was an interesting video. And I'll put a separate link for that in the show notes, so anybody interested in that can go and look. But it's a quick overview of what can happen and what this study came about. But I mean, this is really an interesting case study that they did on this phenomena, and it really is something that I hope never happens. Because I've got relatives down in that area, and I wouldn't want to see them be affected by this. But this thing, I don't even know how many counties this affects, but the whole Central Valley, I think there's a description of the California Central Valley, San Francisco Bay Area, San Diego, all this, Orange counties, several coastal communities, and various riverine communities around the state would be affected.
Oh yeah, it and you know, to put it in perspective, so the Central Valley runs, you know, it's anywhere from 40 to 60 miles wide,
uh-huh.
And it runs about 450 miles from northwest of the state to the southeast part of the state, and it basically starts up near Redding, which is far north in California. You know.
Yeah, you take
close to the Oregon line.
Yeah.
And then Central Valley runs down close, not too far from, it ends not too far from Los Angeles. Bakersfield is the southeasternmost major city in the Central Valley. And so it essentially, if I'm not mistaken, it's about 11% of California's total land area, and it runs, it parallels the Pacific coast.
Yeah.
And it's got, you know, the coastal ranges on the west, and then the Sierra Nevada on the east. And you know, you mentioned that the impact on the rest of the country, the Central Valley is incredibly important because it's California's most productive agricultural region. It's incredibly fertile. I mean, if you look at a satellite map of California, lots of California is kind of dried and parched and blasted. But the Central Valley is this nice 450-mile-long, fertile green field.
Mm-hmm.
And it is California's most productive agricultural region. It's one of the single most productive agricultural regions in the world, as a matter of fact. And it has a tremendous system of reservoirs and canals that irrigates more than 7 million acres of land.
Wow.
In the valley.
Yeah.
And this, as you mentioned, provides more than half the fruits and vegetables and nuts grown in the U.S. As a matter of fact, for some things like almonds, artichokes, dates, figs, kiwi, olives, basically pretty much every tree nut you can think of, that is, if it's grown in the U.S., 99% of it comes from the Central Valley.
Yeah. Can you give us any suggestions that people might need to do some more research or prepare?
Well, for preparation, I think always have a plan in place, how you plan to ride out any kind of disaster, what you're going to do if you have to evacuate. I mean, because this thing is, you know, again, 2008 numbers, at least 1.5 million people in the Central Valley could be forced to evacuate. And so you got to know where you might go. You need to plan ahead. So you don't end up I got to go to a government shelter or a Red Cross shelter. You have to have supplies so that you can take with you. Also, people who may be affected by an arc storm need to research it. Follow the links on the show page, learn about it, and then also get involved in their community and in their state and work with their state representatives, their elected representatives at the state and local level to try to mitigate this, because, you know, the flood protection systems in California are designed to handle 100 to 200 year rainfalls, not 1,000 year rainfalls like an arc storm.
Yeah.
So
that it could be devastating. It could be.
Yep.
So civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster. This is why we strongly suggest establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook at Civil Defense Radio and on Twitter at civil_def_radio, where we post information about the many threats we see to our safety and security as a nation. We wish to thank Drew again for being with us and giving us all this great information, and our friends and listeners who are with us every week. We couldn't do this without you. I really appreciate you guys being with us this week. So please, be safe, be informed, and be prepared. God bless you, and keep you until next time.